Okay, there's about hi, who's here?
It's Craig McKee just joined.
Hey, Craig. There's about seven of us here already.
What's that, sorry?
There's okay. Who just came on? Hi, who just came on?
Sue Sarpa.
Hi, Susan. Welcome back.
Oh, Ken, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you doing?
Good,
hi, Sue. Hi, Sue. This is Frank in Western Mass.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, it's been a while. How you doing?
Good. I've been kind of hibernating.
Okay. Spring is tomorrow, March 1st.
While we're waiting for our usual latecomers, let's go ahead and get a preliminary list so Craig can note the attendance. So far, Craig, offhand, I'd say Jeff Boss is here already, and Susan Sarpa, Dwayne Dietz, Paul Zaremka, yourself, myself. Who else? Who am I missing?
Ned Delaney
is here. Who else?
Tom Tweeden,
okay. How do you pronounce your last name, Tom?
This is Diana Castillo.
Tweeden.
Tweeden?
Tweeden, like Sweden with a T.
Tweeden, okay. All right, sorry, who just got here?
Diana Castillo.
Diana?
Castillo.
Castillo.
I'm Castillo, C-A-S-T-I-L-L-O. I'm on the list under the Investigaron PS because I started the 9/11 group in Spain.
Uh-huh. Okay, which group are you with again?
Investigar 11S.
Great.
But I'm also with DC 9/11 Truth now because I came back to the States.
Okay, did you get all that, Craig?
I didn't get the name of the group. I'm having my audio
DC 911,
right,
DC 911 Truth, and what was the other one?
It's Investigar. It's like investigation.
Yeah, Investigar. Uh-huh.
11S.
Well, we certainly welcome you. You're the first. You're the first person with bilingual to join our conference. So you're very welcome.
Good. I never called when I was in Spain because it was too late.
Sure. Well, we're really glad you could join us. Who else has just got on the call?
James Hufford,
okay. Okay, anybody else whose name we didn't mention? Oops, here comes another one.
Frank Tulipko here in Berkshire 911 Truth. Did you get me?
What's your name?
Frank Tulipko, Berkshire 911 Truth.
Were you able to hear that, Craig?
No, I couldn't at all.
Yeah, we're getting interference. Let's try it again. Say it again, please.
Frank Tulipko, Berkshire 911 Truth.
Okay, right, yeah. That's your friend.
Okay.
Great, thank you. Okay. All right, well, I think that's enough to get started with. Looks like there's about 3, 6, 9, 11 of us here. Laura Cattleman is not here, I guess, yet, so hopefully she'll be here before her part of the agenda comes up.
I just joined the call also. Do you want everyone's name or did?
Yeah, we should take attendance. Is this Laura?
No, this is Cheryl Curtis in Connecticut.
Oh, hi, Cheryl. Welcome.
Thanks.
Yeah, what group are you with?
Connecticut 911 Truth.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay.
Got that, Craig?
Yep.
Craig?
Yeah, I got that. So I'm.
Okay.
To read what I've got so far?
Yeah, why don't you do that, and then we'll go ahead and get started.
Okay, I have Susan Sarpa, Ken Freeland, Craig McKee, Jeff Boss, Wayne Dietz, Paul Zaremka, Ned Delaney, Tom Tweeden, Diana Castillo, James Hufford, Frank Tulipko, Cheryl Curtis.
Anybody? Great. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started then. This is the 9/11 Truth teleconference for February 27, 2013. The roll call we've completed. Approval of previous teleconference minutes as posted by Craig and circulated. Any need to amend those? Hearing no call for amendment, the minutes are taken for approved. Tonight's agenda was circulated twice. There was a revised agenda circulated, and that's the draft we're working from. Does anybody have any amendment of the agenda to propose?
Paul Zarembka has a comment.
Paul?
Yeah, I thought there was a strict rule that all the agenda items had to be in by Saturday, the day beforehand, so I'd like to ask how those additional items got on the agenda. Was it because you made a mistake or what?
Yes, I made the mistake of omitting the Jeff Boss item, which had already been agreed to on our teleconference list serve, so I had to go back and include that. And meanwhile, I had gotten word from Tom that he would like to do a brief report. So I, as a courtesy, I just included it as well. Those were the only two items, I think, that were added that weren't on there before.
Okay, I would like to move that by unanimous, well, by two-thirds vote, that the second item be included on today's agenda.
Which was that?
The one from Tom, the one that you did was not, that was.
Oh, okay, okay. You want to, okay, well,
the one that,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Any objections to including the omitted item that were included in the revised agenda? Hearing none, then we'll take the revised agenda as our working agenda for tonight. The first item is, thank you for that. The first item on the agenda is a planned media blitz in advance of coming anniversary of 9/11. I have been in conversation with somebody else. I actually can't do that because Laura's not here. Laura, are you on the call yet? Laura Kedelman? No? That's too bad. She seemed pretty eager to join us, but maybe she'll come later. So we'll just postpone that item if there's no objection and move on to the next item. Topical discussion, the controversy. Oh, wait a moment. We can't do that one either because Wayne Matson's not here yet either.
Well, yeah, I can.
Yeah.
Interject something. Yeah. I talked with Wayne and informed him we were second on the list, so he's going to come on at 8:30.
Fair enough. Okay. We'll just, if there's no objection, we'll just postpone that until Dwayne comes on. That brings us up to our introduction to Jeff Boss. We've talked in the past very much about our need to support politicians who pass the 9/11 truth litmus test, and Jeff Boss is running, among other things, for mayor of New York. And he says that the 9/11 was an inside job done by NSA.
Yeah.
That's correct. Jeff,
yeah,
you want to give us a brief?
Oh, sure. Can I go ahead?
Yeah, just go ahead and if you give us a brief outline of your position
okay.
on 9/11.
Sure.
And remember that we're mostly concerned about 9/11 here, but the idea is to get your get publicity for your campaign based on the
right.
fact that you are an open 9/11 truther who's running for a pretty important position.
Yeah, I'm running for the Democratic primary for mayor of New York. I'm also running for governor of New Jersey. And my website
yep.
is bossformayor.com. And I also have another website, bossforsenate.com. I've been on the ballot twice for president in a whole bunch of states, U.S. Senate, Congress, State Senate. I've run 8 times for office. I'm considered a whistleblower on the National Security Agency. I was in a meeting with one of George Bush's National Security Agents, who is my sister-in-law, 6 months before the 9/11 attack. They were helping a guy named Ramzi Yousaf, who was in prison for the 9/11 bomb at the World Trade Center. They moved him to Washington, to Alexandria, Virginia. She was giving him phone cards to call his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, talking about flying 12 planes into buildings on the same day. I never heard the dates or the building names, but we heard all the details. I got a call on September 10th. I'm meeting at the World Trade Center. 4 people screamed at me not to be late on September 11th and September 12th. By the grace of God, luck, I survived it by seconds. Now, I have Al Gore confirming my story on DVD. I have 50 sworn affidavits in court from high people, respectable people who swore under oath they were threatened by the NASA to keep quiet. I have 500 additional people on camera saying they're threatened by the NSA to keep quiet after I've campaigned them. I've been campaigning for 12 years or 11 years about the 9/11. I sat in a meeting. I heard them plan it. They refused to run me on TV or newspaper. It's a nightmare, but our country did the 9/11 attack. And I'm on a mission to get into office, to get the investigation started, to get our country back. I run I'm running for governor of New Jersey. My website is jeffbarsfornewjerseygovernor.com. My other website is barsforsenate.com, and my one for mayor of New York on the Democratic ticket is barsformayor.com. And I want to say something. Everyone who's talked about the 9/11 should be very proud of themselves, because when I campaigned in New York, 95% of the public knows our government did it. When I first started in 2001, only 5% of the people believed me. Now everybody knows my story, but unfortunately our media is controlled. So be proud of yourselves, because the work you've done has gotten the voice, your voice heard about the truth.
Thank you, Jeff. I know I have a question or two for you, but I'm sure others do too. Would anybody like to be on the stack to
yes,
ask a question?
Yes, I would, James Hufford.
Okay, James, and who else? All right, James, and then myself. Go ahead, James.
Well, I'd just like to know, there's so many people that allege that Mossad had a part in that. Did you see any of that in what you know?
The person who was helping arrange it was bad-mouthed Jews, like it was Hitler talking. So I did never saw any part of Mossad. Now, the Mossad is in bed with the NSA, with their listening devices. They do a lot of their phone monitoring from Israel to avoid the laws in this country. See, they can listen to every phone call in the U.S. illegally in Israel, but they can't do it in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
I also want to add this, and I was friends with the former President Bush. And I spent some time with him. He was drunk the entire time in the White House. He relapsed. There was a large amount of cocaine being used in the White House also. He was an alcoholic, and he lost his sobriety.
Oh.
Yeah.
You were friends with him while he was in the White House?
No, not while he was. I was friends with him before he became
the president. But you know about what was happening in the White House?
Yeah, one of my friends was a consultant to his doctor. They brought this guy named Jeffrey Roskin, who was a guy who treated people for cocaine abuse. He treated Lawrence Taylor, John McEnroe, David Letterman for cocaine abuse. Bush was so out of control, his personal doctor brought this guy down from New York to try to treat him. And this guy, he was telling me how, because I knew Bush, how out of control Bush was in the White House with the drugs.
Which Bush are you talking about?
W.
Huh?
The last one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to ask you, a major part of your story is that the four people invited told you to be sure to be on time on 9/11 to the World Trade Center. Well, what was the nature of your occupation then that had you going to
work? I was working at the time. I had worked at Morgan Stanley, a big brokerage house. I had brought AOL Public for them in 1993, Donna Karen, DreamWorks, and Four Seasons Hotels when I was on the road trip desk. I was a broker working for a firm, and they told me to be there. They were opening a new office. They had a new office at the World Trade Center, to be there early. So it was my first day in new office. I'd never been there before. And just by the grace of God, whatever it was, eating coffee, I missed it by seconds. And a lot of people got killed.
Yeah. Okay. Who else has a question or a comment?
What was the name of the doctor,
the name of the doctor who was treating Bush was Jeffrey Roskin, R-O-S-E-C-A-N. And he's dead. They killed him. He was talking
How about the specialist that he brought in?
The specialist they brought in, he's dead. The girl, listen, there's like a couple dozen people that are dead because of it. What happened was George Bush was in the Betty Ford Center in 1989 because his father had caught him sniffing coke in Camp David back in September, October of 1989. His father put him in the Betty Ford Center, and when he ran for president, the people that were patients with him, a lot of them met with accidents and are dead. So they got rid of the people. They didn't want someone to speak up and say, hey, I was in rehab with Bush. They clobbered the people. Now, this guy Roskin, you can probably Google him and find his name. He died of lung cancer 3 weeks after he met with Bush's doctor and said, get him out of office. He told Bush's main doctor to get him out of office. The girl in Washington who was having an affair, a girl I knew was having an affair with a congressman, her name was Chris Detline. she, I called her when they, when Roskin dropped dead, or died of lung cancer. I called her and told her to bring the file about Bush to a congressman. She had a heart attack before she got one step out of her door. She died. There's about a dozen other people who I asked to bring this stuff public, and they're all dead. So, you know. It's on my website, bossforsenate.com.
Is your, can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is your, does your website include the list of the people at that meeting who discussed what was to become September 11th? And is it pretty precise about what was actually said at that
meeting? I'll give it to you. It's on there, but the person's name is being blocked. The key person, her name was Kathy Paquette, P-A-U-K-E-R-T, P-A-U-K-R-T. She's married to my brother, Leonard Barrett Boss. She was a liaison for the NSA. Whenever they had some operation they wanted to do, they would use her. She they met my brother on this big Russell, this guy named Russell, I forgot his last name, Russell Watson. He killed a couple of Capitol cops. Anyway, the NSA was involved trying to make sure there's no other people involved. She was later on helping this guy, Ramzi Yousof. Now, Ramzi Yousof, and she told us, was in jail for the 1993 bomb at the World Trade Center. He had also taught Tim McVeigh how to make bombs when he was in the Philippines. They moved him out of prison, and my sister-in-law, Kathy Paquette, was helping Ramzi Yousof by providing him phone cards and calling his uncle, who was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was considered the mastermind of the 9/11 attack, taught him about flying 12 planes into buildings on the same day. We heard a lot of the details. We heard names of the people involved. I didn't hear the building names. I didn't hear the dates. I have my brother was scared. He was negotiating a jail sentence for his wife right after the attack. Said, you know, she helped do it. We're going to try to get her 15-year sentence out in 5 years. He came to me a few weeks later and said the government threatened to kill him and his family if he proceeded with it with the Department of Justice, and he dropped out.
Okay. I've heard two more people, I think, enter the call since we started this discussion. Who else is here that we don't have on our list yet?
This is Wayne Manson.
Who? I'm sorry, say it again?
This is Wayne Manson here.
Oh, Wayne. Oh, welcome. Okay, I'm glad you could make it. Okay. And who else joined the call recently?
It was actually Craig. My line went dead, and I had to redial, so this is coming
back. Oh, okay. No problem. Okay, thanks. All right. So you got a Wayne Manson this year also, okay?
Yeah.
I'd like to add this to the most frustrating thing is that I can't get any press run any stories about me. When I got the Wall Street Journal run a page 2 article about me a month ago, they only said that I was a 9/11 truther. They wouldn't go into any details. I can't get any mainstream media to acknowledge that I'm running for mayor on the Democratic ticket. I'm the only candidate that National Public Radio, WNYC New York, won't have on the air. They completely block my media coverage. The people know it's true, but the media is completely controlled in this government.
Welcome to the club, Jeff.
It's very frustrating. It's like running up a big hill and getting to the top and getting pushed down every day. But I'm out there fighting. I dedicated all my time and effort and money to saving this country. I took all my money made from Wall Street and used it to run for office. I've been on about 6 different times. I'm on my 11th time running for office.
Do you have a campaign staff yet working with you?
I got a couple good people who are helping me out. And if any of you want to donate money to my campaign, it's used directly only for my whole story is the 9/11 thing to get my voice heard. I got posters up in New York, in Washington, all over the place, but every bit helps. And it's bossformayor.com if anyone wants to donate $5 or $10.
Do you have anything in Spanish?
No, but I would love to. I really should put a website in Spanish. That would actually be a good idea. Thank you.
You could send me like a short thing in Spanish. I could publish it in our Spanish blog.
All right. My first wife was Spanish. I can ask her too. But if you want to send it, it's bossformayor.com. Any part of it you want to translate for me and email back to me at jeffboss1@aol.com would be very, very much appreciated. I'll put it up on the website in Spanish.
Well, the thing is that I'm not sure if I have time to translate it. That's
well,
why
I'll get my first wife to do it. It's okay. But thank you for the suggestion. I forgot all about that, and a lot of people in New York are Spanish.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good point. Okay, I think we're about out of time on this issue, but Jeff, thank you so much for coming in and giving.
Be proud of yourselves, because every one of you, the public knows it's true. That's the first step. Everybody knows it's true. 95% of the people in New York say we know our government did it. They don't seem to understand that we've lost our constitution and our freedoms.
Yep.
But keep up the good work, people. Be proud of yourself.
Jeff, we wish you the best, and we will put a link to your website in our minutes that go out to the other 9/11 Truth invitees.
Thank you very much.
Most of them are not here tonight, okay?
Okay,
thank you so much, and good luck.
If anyone wants to come meet me, I'm in front of the 160 Barrack Street tomorrow morning from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. We're having a demonstration of NPR. Just a couple people, and because they won't broadcast me.
Okay.
Take care. Thanks.
Thank you again, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Okay, that was very interesting. And now we'll back to our topical discussion that we were postponing until Wayne could make it, and he's here now. So, Ned, did you want to introduce the topic?
Sure. The topic at hand has to do with the untimely death of 9/11 author, investigator, Philip Marshall. And there, what really drove all this was a Kevin Barrett posting on Veterans Today, in which he interviewed Wayne Madsen. And subsequently, I contacted Wayne Madsen in reference to the interview to see if he'd be willing to come on and discuss his insights. He conducted a week-long investigation on site of this on this particular case, and really has quite a bit of insight on this, and I thought would be relevant considering the topic at hand. There's other information I could give in the background of Marshall in the book, but I think I would just soon relinquish the time and give Wayne the heads up at this point.
Okay. Wayne, welcome to the call. You want to go ahead and just run with this and give us the skinny on what you researched on it?
Sure. Yeah. Ned, if I leave anything out, because I've been doing a lot of interviews recently, you know, add in anything that I omit. But first I want to preface my comments by saying I wasn't familiar with Phil Marshall. There is a slight chance I may have met him at one of the 9/11 functions, either in Washington or New York in the past, but he looked familiar, but I don't recall having any sort of conversation with him. So for all purposes, I was not really aware of his work, but when I read about his death and the circumstances, I immediately started looking at what he had written. I was really interested in his first book. He wrote three. His first book was a docu-novel called Lakefront Airport about his time flying Barry Seal, the CIA, DEA, Colombian drug cartel informant around in the early days of Iran-Contra. So this would have been the early part of the Reagan administration, early 80s, 80, 83, 84. In 85, Marshall left the employment of the CIA as a contractor and joined Eastern Airlines as a commercial airline pilot. And when Frank Lorenzo took that airline over and tried to bust up the unions, the pilot unions and the other unions there, he went over to work for United because he didn't want to he basically said he didn't want to be a SCAB pilot. So Marshall, a native of New Orleans, he retired from United Airlines, moved to Santa Barbara, California some years back, and then about 10 years ago he sold his home before the housing market collapsed in Santa Barbara. I understand he made a fairly good a profit on the home, and then he bought a home up in Murphy's, California, a very remote area just northeast of Angels Camp, which was popularized by Mark Twain with the frog jumping events there. And Marshall lived in a subdeveloped gated community called Forest Meadows. Now the story is that Saturday midday to early afternoon, Marshall was discovered dead in his home by neighbors and some friends of the children of Marshall's two kids. He had a 17-year-old son, Alex, and a 14-year-old daughter, Michaela. They did not show up for school on Friday. They didn't tweet or Facebook or any form of communications to their high school friends, who grew very concerned when they didn't hear anything by Saturday. So the four of them showed up at the home on Saturday, didn't see anybody, except they noticed a person laying at the end of the hallway on the floor, so they contacted a neighbor immediately, who then went into the home. The door was unlocked, which was very unusual in itself. Marshall was not paranoid or anything, but he did express his concerns on occasion based on what he had been writing to some friends, that, you know, I have to always kind of look out for myself and, you know, be careful of my personal safety. The county sheriff, the Calaveras County Sheriff, showed up at the scene, shooed off all the non-law enforcement personnel, put the yellow tape around the house, and started to conduct their investigation. And by Saturday evening, they claimed they had completed it and were already calling friends of Marshall. To his wife was actually out of the country on a business trip to Turkey at the time, so they contacted his friend and asked if they could get a professional cleaning crew in there to clean up the blood and whatnot.
Excuse me just a minute, Wayne. Whoever just came out of the call, please mute your phone. It's *6 because there's background noise that's interfering with our ability to hear what Wayne's saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll hit the mute button. But this is Lenny in Boston.
Okay, hi, Lenny. *6.
Hi, how are you? *6?
Yeah. There we go. Okay, please proceed,
okay.
Wayne. Thank you. Wayne.
Okay, so Calaveras County Sheriff showed up at the crime scene. They almost immediately put out the word after only a few hours of investigating it that Marshall had taken his registered 9mm Glock, shot his son and his daughter, who were sleeping on separate sections of a U-shaped sectional couch. So, you know, he's got the two long parts of the couch and then the short part at the end. They were sleeping on different parts of the long parts of the couch in the living room. Marshall then shot the pet dog that was in a bedroom and then turned the gun on himself. The only thing the sheriff released, and this was to a family, I believe it was to his wife, at the memorial service for the children, that they found Phil Marshall's wedding ring on a box of 9mm ammunition, that they thought that was significant. However, everyone who knew Phil Marshall said, look, he hadn't worn his wedding ring since he had separated from his wife about 7 years ago. It was a very amicable separation. As a matter of fact, Marshall was actually trying to set his soon-to-be ex-wife up in her own buying business, importing things like linens and soaps and saffron from Turkey, obviously for the many gift shops in the area, because this part of California gets a huge influx of tourists, especially in the summertime. So he was trying to get her on her own financial feet. But immediately, there was an attempt to assassinate the character of Phil Marshall. One of the local newspapers, the one in Sonora, which is in a neighboring county, the Union Democrat, published a story that was full of a lot of attacks on Marshall. They actually took a call from Marshall's first wife, who he hadn't seen since 1988, who really laid on a lot of information that they reprinted gladly, that, you know, Marshall was bipolar, he was violent, he made up this story about him flying for the CIA. It was all his fantasy, and they published that. Within the last few hours, the editor of that paper has tried to, he contacted me, I tried to contact him back. Apparently they're writing a column, and I'm hoping that maybe, but I'm not keeping my hopes up on this, I'm hoping that they might do a mea culpa on the attack they made against Phil Marshall. The other paper out there was much fairer. These are local papers, by the way. They didn't get the major papers. None of the San Francisco papers sent anyone up there. As a matter of fact, I was the only reporter who actually gained access to Forest Meadows into the gated community and got photographs of the house. The only thing I'll add is Marshall had written three books, and he told some friends that he was working on yet a fourth that was going to have some real shocking information. Nobody knows what happened to his computer. No one knows what happened to his notes, although I snapped a photograph at his front door. There were about 9 banker's boxes empty sitting there, and I don't know whether they once contained files that were removed or someone brought the boxes to put files in, and they had a few too many that they left there, but it was quite apparent that somebody was very interested in the files, the computer. We don't know what happened to it, whether it's in the hands of the county sheriff as evidence. The investigation, they claim, is over, although the GSR, the gunshot residue report, has not been released, nor has the toxicology report, and that may take another week or two to come back from Sacramento. Cal Bears County Sheriff stated that this was a county matter. There was no state involvement yet. After the yellow tape was lifted that Sunday, which was February the 3rd, there were 5 vehicles spotted on 2 different occasions in the Marshall driveway. On one occasion, 3 SUVs, 1 California state tag, another one tag undetermined with communication antennas on the roof. And on another occasion at night, about 5 to 6 law enforcement officers were combing the back of the house, the side of the house, in the house with flashlights around 9 o'clock in the evening. This was after the yellow tape was lifted, and they concluded that Marshall killed himself. The disposition of the body, the children were cremated, and Marshall has been cremated, and he's not going to be laid to rest until around Easter time at a service in his native New Orleans.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, Wayne. That's certainly a lot to absorb. Does anybody have a question for Wayne on this, or a comment on the issue?
This is Tom in Arkansas.
Wayne,
I think that Phil's main thesis was that the Saudis did it, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
He said the Saudis were, of course, involved, the Saudi government, but he also added that it was elements of the Bush administration, including that the 9/11 had the knowledge of Bush and Cheney, and he also said, and it involved top neocons in the administration. So that is where he put the blame.
Okay.
Now, this is Ned.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's been some discussion, at least on the teleconference, about Silverstein and various Zionist or Israeli interaction with the events of 9/11. I've gotten through about half of the Big Bamboozle. I haven't been able to read the False Flag 9/11, but and I'm not sure, and I haven't listened to the Coast to Coast interview, but I was curious as to whether or not at any time, was there any other indication that there were other factions involved other than the Saudis with the various events?
By the way, the Coast interview, basically, the same ground I covered with the Kevin Barrett interview. But Marshall actually continued to say that there was a lot of fake. He did not believe that the SEAL Team 6 killed Bin Laden at the compound in Abbottabad. He said that was a made-for-Hollywood extravaganza. He basically just believed that the government was lying about everything since 9/11. Of course, we have here a guy who flew Barry Seal around, and now there's been sort of a pushback against Marshall by some people who claim, you know, he didn't break any new ground, but the ground he broke was as a commercial pilot who flew the 777, the Boeing 757, and he flew the Boeing 767, the two types of aircraft used. He had knowledge that a lot of people didn't have about what happened. So he thought a pilot's perspective. I don't think he the fact that he said the neocons were involved in 9/11. Of course, he's talking about people like Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and all the others who have close ties with the Israelis. One of his books was published by a small publisher, and I believe the other two were self-published by and print-on-demand type publications. And he was, as I say, he was working on yet a fourth book, and I think this is of interest because the avatar that he used on his Twitter account for his Twitter messages was the avatar showing the members of the Group of 40 in Mexico City in February 1963. That was Felix Rodriguez, Porter Doss, and Barry Seal, all sitting, the three of them together, and some other unknown individuals. But this Group of 40 was the group that was trying to kill Castro, and it included people like Ted Shackley, Thomas Kleins, Edwin Wilson, and David Atlee Phillips. And David Atlee Phillips, of course, was Lee Harvey Oswald's control officer in both Mexico City and Dallas and New Orleans, for that matter. So I'm curious as to whether Marshall was using this year, the 50th anniversary of the assassination, to bring out something that maybe Seal had told him or something that Seal had arranged for him to get at some point in time or something somebody had handed him because of his past relationship with Barry Seal. And certainly, so whoever did this to him, and I went out there to California skeptical about the sheriff's explanation or conclusion, came away feeling that, there was absolutely no way this man, with the relationship he had with his children, would have done something like that.
Wayne, Tom in Arkansas, one more time. Do you know if was Phil in any way associated with the Civil Air Patrol, like Barry Seals and like Lee Harvey Oswald? That was right north of New Orleans in Mandeville, right across the lake. And both pilots. Do you know if he had any association with the Civil Air Patrol down there?
No, I'm not aware that he did. Of course, he did not. He was not ex-military, so he became a pilot. It's a good question. It's a good thing to try to find out. It's a good area to look at. He had gone in. He had not been in the military. He became a pilot first. He flew a Learjet when Seal lost his pilot's license. Basically, Marshall was flying around. Marshall was pretty young at the time. He was about 24, 25 years old when he was flying around. As a matter of fact, there's a photograph of Phil Marshall standing next to his Learjet. He was a tall guy, by the way, about 6'2", 6'3". There's a photograph of him standing next to the CIA Learjet at Mena, Arkansas. I thought that was pretty interesting, especially for those who are now attacking him, saying it's a fantasy and he made all this Barry Seal stuff up. You know, how do you place him in mean of all places? And that was a center, a nexus for a lot of the drug weapons smuggling during the whole Iran-Contra time frame. He also, after Marshall went to work for Eastern, he told a good friend of his, he said, look, I was watching television one day and the news was on and I saw this guy raise his right hand before a joint Senate-House investigation committee, wearing a Marine uniform, and he told his friend, he said, hey, I know that, I met that guy at Lakefront Airport. That was Oliver North.
Wayne, as James Hufford, wouldn't you think that with his background with NSA and so forth, that that Marshall would be likely to also store his files in more than one place for the book he was working on? I mean,
well,
couldn't there be an extant copy somewhere?
Yeah, that's something I'm looking into. I've spoken to some people who helped him write his last book. Anyway, they were involved in his last book, and I'm trying to see if he used any sort of cloud or any sort of, you know, put stuff in safekeeping with other people. I should bring up the fact that he has a family, he has a brother, he has a sister, and his cousin. All these people flew out to California when this happened, but they had a memorial service at the high school for the children, and Marshall's relatives were not permitted to attend that. They were barred from attending that by, I assume it was the estranged wife, but they held a service at a small church for him and his family and his close friends at the time, but some of his friends and colleagues in his writing did not make it up to the service, but I have been in touch with some of them to try to find out if he made arrangements to store any of this material with them.
Yeah, it just seems like it would be a good bet with his background that he would. Would you be sure and update us on what you find, please?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm still working the case. It's there's still more information in dribs and drabs coming to me every day.
Mm-hmm. Good. Great.
Okay. Anybody else have a quick question before we move on to the next item?
Yeah, this is Paul Zaremka.
Paul?
Yeah. Wayne, I want to change the subject just a little bit, and you can just tell me it's too much, but you have this book out on the manufacturing of the president with the connections, with the CIA connections to Obama's mother and stepfather and possibly father, and I would just like to know what is the significance of your findings for us, or if that's too big a topic, then just tell me so.
No, I'll quickly just say, I think you saw, if anyone saw the Academy Awards the other night, I think you saw yet further proof that this family has just an immense interest and a great amount of respect for the CIA. When Michelle Obama gave the Best Picture award to Argo, which was the CIA film, after all, they were pushing for it, and the word is that they really politicked for that film to beat out Lincoln. You know, it's quite clear that more than the two auditors with Price Waterhouse Coopers knew what picture was going to get that, because they had arranged for her to give this award to them, and it's very similar to in 2010 when the Obamas and Sasha, the other girl was off in summer camp, made an impromptu visit to the International Spy Museum. This is before they even took their kids to the Smithsonian. And the Spy Museum in Washington is a campy commercial operation. It has a bunch of CIA guys, of course, tire types. But, what it means is that Obama is basically, I believe, more in bed with the CIA than George W. Bush was. Even though Bush's dad was the director, look at Obama bringing about 8 to 9 Espionage Act charges against whistleblowers who talk to the media, including people in the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, and his assurances to the CIA that nobody was going to be disciplined or reprimanded for torture, for rendition. He kept Guantanamo open. He broke that campaign promise, and he's put John Brennan, who is basically a clandestine services officer in charge of the agency. Here's an individual who has worked in shadows for most of his time in government, and he, of course, was the president of the company that rifled through Obama and his family's passport file in January 2008 while running and basically cleaned out the file. So what we don't know about Stanley Armour Dunham, Stanley Ann Dunham, Madeline Dunham, and Barack Obama himself, Jr., was the courtesy of John Brennan.
Ha, ha, ha. Well answered. Okay. I think we got pretty far past time on this one, but I think everyone would agree that it was time well spent. Wayne, thank you so much for joining us tonight and bringing us up to date. And like James asked, please keep us informed in the future as things break. We really appreciate it. You know, we're all appreciative of the work that you're doing and researching.
Okay, thank you. You bet.
Thanks.
Thank you,
Wayne. Good night, everybody.
Thanks, Wayne.
Take Wayne. Okay, let's see. The next item is, Laura Tatum did not come on the call yet, did she? No, guess not. Am I still on the call?
You are, yes.
Okay, all right. I thought I accidentally X'd myself off here. Okay, the next item is Tom Treaton. You want to talk about your Barrett interview? Your interview on the Kevin Barrett show?
Yes.
Before that? Okay.
Yes. This is Tom Treaton in Arkansas. I'm a physician and read Jeff Prager's book online, America Nuked, and found it very interesting. Researched it a little bit more, but being a physician, I was particularly interested in the increase in the radiation or now almost certainly radiation-induced illnesses in the people that were first responders and worked the pile. And one of the illnesses is a rare form of cancer called multiple myeloma. There's here in Arkansas, I help teach residents here at the University Hospital and am affiliated and associated with that institution, UAMS, University of Arkansas Medical Sciences Campus. But anyway, we have a myeloma institute here, and so that's one of the areas that our particular hospital specializes in, and so I was very interested in the increase in incidence of, or the stated increase in incidence of multiple myeloma in people that work the pile. And so what I did was, rather than just accept the information that that Jeff Prager presented, I called around in New York City area and to some of the oncology centers and was able to speak with a oncologist that specializes in multiple myeloma, a plasma cell disease, and he works at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital and Cancer Research Institute. And he confirmed that there was definitely an
an unusual increase in the incidence of multiple myeloma in the population of people that were associated with working at Ground Zero on the day of and after 9/11. And multiple myeloma is an interesting bone cancer. For one thing, it's extremely aggressive. It's usually terminal. It causes a great deal of pain, and the treatment is extremely aggressive and extremely expensive. So that it's different than many of the other illnesses in that it has strikes a very specific age group usually, and that is elderly people. The vast majority are the majority above 63, greatest incidence in the 65 to 70 year old group, and it strikes male or female and strikes African Americans more commonly than Caucasians, but the incidence in the thing that's striking about the increased incidence of myeloma in the group of people that worked the pile is that these are in younger people that were in their 20s and 30s, are now in their 30s and 40s, and this particular cancer is extremely rare in that group of people, yet it's very common or extremely, there's an extremely high incidence. Well, I asked the doctor at Sloan Kettering, a doctor, Hassoun, if they had any idea of as to the etiology of increased incidence of cancer in this group of people. And his statement was that no, they had no idea other than they were exposed to lots of toxins in the pile. And of course, there's been absolutely nothing that we know of, or that I found by now more extensive research of the subject, that it's known to increase the incidence of exposure to chemical exposures of various kinds of dust or other elements. We don't know of any increase of the relationship of exposure to anything that increases your risk of multiple myeloma except for exposure to ionizing radiation. So you can almost presume that the people working at Ground Zero were exposed to increased doses of ionizing radiation. There are other cancers that are highly associated with exposure to this kind of radiation, and those cancers are, one of those cancers is cancer of the thyroid, and there has also been an increased incidence of thyroid in the same group of people, and the increased incidence of these rare cancers in the group of people that work the pile seems to correspond to the same increase in incidence of the same cancers in survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and in people that were downwind from Chernobyl. So it's very interesting. This instance of illness can be expected to continue to increase over the years, looking at these other groups, the groups that have been exposed in Chernobyl and Hiroshima and probably down the road, Fukushima. But again, this is, to me, an extremely important smoking gun, and I think that it really suggests the need for much greater investigation of this at a much higher level. And in my research of this subject, I found that in January of 2011, President Obama signed a legislation that settled a lawsuit brought by 100 survivors of 100 people that worked the pile that were now ill. Some had died, and their families were members of the suit. The suit was settled for $500 million, with apparently 40% of the proceeds going to the legal firm handling the suit. And it seemed to me very much like the payoff or the buy-off of the families of the deceased on 9/11. So that I mitigate for a further cover-up. I have not been able to research this well enough, but will continue to research it. But looking at the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, on 9/13 and 9/14, elected 35 or 38 dust samples from areas close to down zero, and took these off and analyzed them carefully for their content, did a very, very thorough analysis of these dust samples, and the dust samples uniformly showed high levels of very specific and very unusual elements that are not common, deuterium, strontium,
tritium,
that's another very interesting, tritium is all of these are breakdown products of a fission reaction using either plutonium or uranium, and these unstable U-238, these are unstable elements that are used for nuclear weapons, and they break down in specific chemical reaction pattern, and so they're the products of the final products, their breakdown are predictable and predictable in specific ratios, and these final products, which are predictable in these specific ratios, according to Jeff Prager, are found in all of the dust samples that were collected by the USGS and studied, and that's not proprietary information. That's accessible to anyone that goes to their site. I went to their site and haven't found these specific spectrographic and other forms of mass spectrometer studies. But if what Jeff Prager says is true, it seems to also corroborate the work of Dr. Ed Ward. And it's almost as like having a fingerprint of what happened, because some of these unusual elements that are found in these spectroscopic samples are not even found. I mean, they are man-made. Deuterium is an incredibly rare substance. Cesium is another. And these are found in very high concentrations in the dust samples, and the concentrations are in the same ratio or relationship to each other in all of the samples tested. So I think that this information is very important, and I will continue to explore the issue. I am currently going to try to encourage Stephen Jones to basically discuss this issue with Jeff Prager on Kevin Barrett's radio program. I think that would be extremely helpful to hear, because Stephen Jones is a nuclear physicist. I asked Stephen Jones about this subject back in Arizona at the Accountability Conference in February of 2007. I happened to have an opportunity to just sit and have a cup of coffee with Dr. Jones and his wife, And I asked him about Dr. Ed Ward's work and suggesting that perhaps mini nukes were used, and he immediately put me in my place, said it was impossible, that and because the tritium levels in Lower Manhattan were the same the day before 9/11, on 9/11, and after 9/11, and you can't have a fission reaction that does not create an elevation in tritium level. Well, I'm not a nuclear physicist, so I took that as evidence. Jeff Prager and Ed Ward point to the fact that there is a definite increase in the tritium levels at ground zero in the days and weeks after 9/11. So I don't know, Dr. Jones somehow had this information at his fingertips in February of 2007, and I don't know where he got it, but he has worked with nuclear physicists, worked with cold fusion, worked with muon catalyzed fusion reactions that are part of the trigger for what's called the neutron bomb. He worked with the he worked at Lawrence Livermore Labs on this very subject, and so if anybody knows about it, Stephen Jones knows about it, and so I'm trying to contact Dr. Jones and would ask him then to bring forth his information and discuss this in the open, having Jeff Prager and perhaps Dr. Ed Ward on the in the debate, and they could bring their challenge each other's information with fact. Anyway, that was basically what I was I was on Kevin Barrett's show this past Monday, and that was basically the information I brought forward and what I wanted to say on the call here.
Thank you, Tom. If I could ask you very quickly here, what would you say would be the incidence of this multiple myeloma in New York compared, and what was the incidence in Hiroshima? Do we know?
I don't know the incidence. I just know that it's a cancer that is related to exposure to ionizing radiation, and the incidence in the general public is about between 1 and 3 per 100,000 per year. But the incidence is in elderly people generally. It is found in younger people, but rarely. Whereas the incidence that they're seeing at Sloan Kettering is in younger people, and that's what's puzzling them.
What's the incidence there? What do you understand to be the incidence of it in Kettering?
Well, I'm not sure. Dr. Hassoun wasn't able to give me the exact incidence. It's just been this unusual rise in the number of cases that he's treating. He's treating mainly elderly people in the New York City area that come down with this condition. But now he's also treating this young cohort of people, and the thing they have in common is that they work the pile. And he told me there was a definite, obvious increase. He actually referred me to a few articles in the New York Times related to this, and I looked those articles up and read them, and they actually confirm what he said, but they don't give me the specific numbers either. But there's a cancer registry in New York. And, you know, if I lived in New York State and wasn't still supporting a family and wasn't having to work so much, I would devote more time to this. But if nuclear explosives were used on 9/11, which seems very likely now to me, there two other things would occur, and one of them would be electromagnetic pulses, EMPs, that would have destroyed a lot of the electronic equipment in the surrounding area. So I remember right after 9/11, Rudy Giuliani got roasted for you know, buying Motorola radios that didn't work so that the police couldn't communicate with each other and couldn't communicate with the fire department.
Yep.
And it was said because he did it on a no-bid contract, yada, yada. And it could be that, or it could be that those particular Motorola devices were sensitive to this electromagnetic pulse that was possibly generated. Another thing that I think we've all seen that sort of corroborates this is the, if remembering the two firemen, the black fireman and the white guy that had been in the lobby and talked about why they're sitting on a bench, you know, not far from the Twin Towers after their collapse. And the black guy talks for a while, and then while he's talking, the white guy has a bloody nose. You see the blood?
Yep.
Coming out of his nose. He's sitting there banging his cell phone on his knee and hitting it on his hands. He can't make his cell phone work, and he's pissed off at his cell phone, and he's just, the cell phone's not working. So, you know, of course, that could have been anything else. The tower's down, no signal, whatever. But it just is another. But that's one thing that if all the computers or lots of the computers got fried and they had a lot of problems with personal computers in the area, in the buildings surrounding Ground Zero, that would mitigate toward a EMP, like I'm speaking of. And EMP, when you're exposed to ionizing radiation in a rather high dose, you have weird stuff happen, like you get bloody diarrhea, and you get stomatitis. Your mouth gets super inflamed, and you get your hair falls out, your body hair falls out. Now, if there's a high incidence of this kind, if people started showing up in the emergency rooms and doctors' offices in the days right after 9/11 with these unusual symptoms, that too would mitigate for acute radiation exposure. Another thing that will, I think, bear upon this is if the people that work the file are having a higher elevated frequency of birth defects in their children or spontaneous abortions in their pregnancies or their wives' pregnancies, as they are now in Fallujah, then this too would mitigate strongly for the exposure to radiation. So this is something that is going to be of record and can be researched by you know, anybody that's interested in researching it, because it's public. The public health, the state health departments keep records of this sort of thing. So anyway, it's new ground that has not yet been plowed, and I think that there's a lot of potential. If multiple myeloma is such a tragic, such a horrible disease that anybody that, I mean, it's just, it ruins the lives of the patient and the patient's loved ones. It's just dramatically bad. The pain is intolerable. The bones are eaten up by this cancer, and what are called pathologic fractures occur. You know, you cough and it breaks three ribs. You can take a step and you break your leg. That sort of thing. It's just terrible. And people, if people that have this illness feel that it's related to their exposure to the pile on 9/11, I think it would be hard to shut them up, to buy their silence. So we'll continue to look at this, and I'll continue to report back on my personal research in this area. But you know, 9/11 truth is alive and well.
Thank you for that report, Tom. That was very informative and provocative, and I hope you'll also keep us informed about the developments of getting Stephen Jones and Jeff Prager together on the same Caravan Barrett show if that materializes.
I'll do so.
Okay. Does anybody have a quick comment on what he's reported before we move on?
Yeah, Frank here in the Berkshires. Vividly recall that those Motorola phones did not work way before 9/11, and there was a lot of complaints by the police and fire department before that. So that may not be indicative of radiation. There may be other indications, but I don't think that that's one that can be attributed to that.
This is Nebula. I have a question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Has the speaker had any contact with Judy Wood? She, as I understand, kind of opened the Pandora's box on potential for radiation and mini nuke there at 9/11. I'm just curious as to whether they had any contact with her.
No, I haven't had any contact with Judy. The first time I heard Judy's name is when Stephen Jones made a comment about her in his lecture at Utah Valley State College back in I think it was May of 06. And he mentioned that her as a physics professor that commented that her kerosene stove just heated her house and never melted down or burned up, and that that the grates in her fireplace didn't become weakened and melt. But I found her book, and her book absolutely wonderful because it had the best pictures of Ground Zero. It gave me, not being very familiar with New York, a very clear idea about what was what and where things were. And her final analysis that this was directed energy and using the forces from Hurricane Eric, to me, that seemed like a possibility that wasn't supported by factual information in the text of her book, not meaning that I didn't discount it as wrong. I just didn't think that her point was proved. But I have not spoken with Judy Woods, and I'd really like to do that, too. And I think that if any other people within the 9/11 truth movement that are experts in any way on nuclear physics need to be brought into this conversation.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Tom. That was really enlightening. For our last focus discussion tonight, assuming that Laura Kadelman is not here yet, Laura, are you on the call? Okay. I've asked that we just take a little bit of discussion around the recent publication of the Moral Decoding of 9/11 by Professor John McMurtry of the university there in Canada in Guelph. Has anybody on the call other than I read that presentation?
I have. I'm
not. I read it.
Okay. Let me just say this before I make a quick summary of his point. I really want to encourage everyone in the strongest possible terms to read the entire, unfortunately, 60-page presentation that he makes. But essentially, he is arguing that one can decode the basic ethic behind not just 9/11, but the entire panoply of foreign policy and domestic policy that surrounds the people that are responsible for 9/11. And that basically is what we might call avarice and a need for finance capital to accumulate, okay? That this is really the driving force and that everything can pretty well be explained by it. And I personally find this a very compelling thesis. And I would really appreciate it if others could take a look at it and see whether or not they agree that his presentation is cogent and he makes a good case for this. It's a little bit different from what we usually do. It's not a technical work in the sense that he's not making a particular scientific argument about the evidence of 9/11, but he's summarizing the evidence and showing how the driving force behind it can be identified as this ethic. And I would really... Is anyone else who's read it care to comment on what I've said thus far?
This Tom Ginn in Arkansas. I read this the other day. It's the lead article on in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And so if you go there, you go to articles, and it's their lead article. It was posted there earlier this month. So I found it, you know, 60 some odd pages long and somewhat redundant. But his thesis seemed he made it over and over. He made his point over and over again, and used a lot of very clear examples of the basically the avarice and the psychopathology of the New World Order, if you want to call it that. And I think it was extremely well done in that it very, very carefully defined the mindset of the people that rule this nation and basically the Western world. And according to him, soon to be the entire planet, unless the people of the planet decide to rebel, because this group of individuals that own the reserve banks of the Western nations and own all of the media, the mainstream media on the planet, and own the military-industrial complex and own the energy sector are very small, a small fraction of a percentage of humanity. And it's their desire, of course, to own everything and have everyone be sort of not even second-class citizens.
Yeah.
That's
a good point. Yeah, I think that's well summarized. But I think, too, as he reaches his conclusion, the call is for a legal challenge. But then we have to remember that the criminal justice system is also pretty much owned by the same people and run by them, which makes it a real challenge to figure out how to make a legal legal challenge to this. But I think his point that the criminal justice system is the immunity system for the culture, and when that breaks down, you really don't have anything. So it kind of points to the need for some kind of regeneration or alternative legal justice approach that would enable us to bring finally justice to the victims of 9/11.
Well, that would be something like the World Corridor, except that we're dropped out and Americans are immune from prosecution there. So.
Right.
What do you
do? You know, coincidentally, I just discovered today This thing called the International Tribunal for Crimes of Church and State. Now, this do we have any of our Canadian friends on this call? I don't think we have any tonight. Oh yeah, of course, Craig is here.
Craig.
This was the first case that they brought, and this is an attempt to use common law on an international level in a tribunal. But the first case that they brought to it was the Canadian genocide, so-called, against the Native peoples there during the residential school program and so forth and so on. They made a very compelling case, and they got a judgment. Now, this is not, of course, the same thing as getting it in the International Criminal Court, but it is an attempt to provide an alternative means of review of the implementation of international law in states by using common law rather than the existing criminal justice system, which we all know is corrupt all the way up. So it's something to consider, and I will provide a link for people that are interested in learning more about that. But I was pretty impressed by what they've done, because at the end of the day, I think it is about restoring common law to matters of criminal justice, because the positive law is no longer effective or, objective.
Yeah, I guess we've bounced off of that enough times to find that out, haven't we?
I think so. And the Ellen Mariani decision, I think, was the nail in the coffin for that hope. that we could ever use our criminal justice system or our legal justice system as a means to get justice for the 9/11.
Yeah, that and the April Gallup case.
Yeah, also.
And Ellen Mariani.
Yeah,
we just sent that. Yep. So I will provide the link and encourage people to read that. Maybe in a future call we can have a more in-depth discussion about Professor Mercury's work and the implications for the 9/11 Truth Movement, if that's accessible. Anybody else have anything they would like to discuss about that or anything else before we run the call? I think we'll see what time it is here. Yeah, we got 10 minutes if we want it. Anybody got anything else to discuss? Any announcements? Okay. Everybody knows about Ellen Mariani's case. Well, then I guess we're done for tonight. So thank you all for participation and cooperation. And our next call will be the last Wednesday of March. I don't know what that is offhand, but we'll see you then.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.